In person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternately participate remotely by using the toll-free call-in number or Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SCV Water website. In the event there is a disruption of service, which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public. It is not required, and members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to our administrator to help expedite this process. To participate in public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise hand feature in Zoom or dial *9 when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. When it's your turn to speak, please dial *6 to unmute. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments, first from members attending in person, and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. These will be taken in order of hands raised. The committee then comes to consensus to move this item to the board for consideration. And those items, if there are any items to be considered, to be put on the consent calendar. Any PowerPoint presentations shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCV Water website. Members here tonight of the committee is Director Cawley, Director Kutzite, Director Amarchaj, and myself, Peterson. Any PowerPoint presentations, I would just said that, and then continue to the back page. With that, the first item of business tonight is the Pledge of Allegiance. Director Cawley, would you mind leading us?
You stand and place your right hand over your heart and follow after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God,
individual. Okay. Item number two is public comments. This is time we can take in person public comment first, and then public comment from those attending remotely, and non-items on the agenda. Any cards?
Yes, we do have public comment tonight. Kim Noltenmeyer may take the podium.
Ms. Noltenmeyer.
Kim Noltenmeyer, I've been attending a lot of meetings, and I'm beginning to wonder what the function of this one is. Are you elected because of what I'm seeing on the agendas? Is everything I protest? And I'm just wondering what's going on. Are you elected individuals to this position? And if so, how was it formed? Or what is your purpose? Because I'm against everything you have on your agenda, basically. And I'm very concerned if any of this gets passed. And if we have to go back to doing, you know, recalls, or what do we have to do to get that we're being represented, if not some underlying reason for what's going on. And, so I have item number three also I want to talk to at that time. But I'm just letting you know where I'm coming from, is that we spend too many at these meetings, and I'm going, who are they? Why are they here? And what are they doing? And I don't have any good answers. And I'm hoping that you can tell me what your purpose is, how you got into your position, because hopefully we're back originally to the having elected officials only that we have to deal with, not ones that aren't elected. If you're elected, just exactly when and how, and that is the information I would need from all of you, what your purpose is, because there's some very serious things that are on your agenda. And I'll get to those as they come up. But right now, I want it made clear that each and every one of you, were you elected or why are you here? That's two simple questions. All right. And I believe my time is about up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Notemeyer. Yeah, go ahead.
November. Yeah, we've, if you look at our website, the information on all of our directors is up there, and we are all elected, and the election cycles and information is on there. Thank you.
Any other public comment?
No other public comment at this time. Oh, I'm sorry. We do actually, somebody online has raised their hand.
All right.
Oh, hi, this is Lynn Plambeck. I just wanted to say that the Zoom login information on the front of the committee report is not correct. So I'm having to call in, which I don't really like to do, and I would prefer to listen and watch. And I think this is not the first time this has happened, so I don't know if you're just using the old agenda faces every time and the Zoom doesn't get updated or what, but if you have the correct Zoom, I would appreciate someone emailing me it so that I can join by Zoom. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you. Hello.
Hi there. I'd be happy to resend that information to you. This is actually the April committee. So
yeah, I'm on the April committee meeting.
Okay.
I'm looking at the agenda for the April committee meeting.
If you would like to give me your email address, I can email it again or send you a direct link.
Okay. It's Lynn Plambeck, LynnePL1@juno.com. Thank you.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that first part?
LynnePL1@juno.com.
Okay. I have your email address, Lynn. I'll send it right away. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Any further comments?
No other public comment at this time.
Okay, thank you, Erica. So we move on to item number 3. And this will be a presentation by Rochelle, starting out to be a presentation by Rochelle Patterson. And it's the recommend approval of a resolution establishing the Valencia Retail Service Area Capacity Fee. I want to just point out a little bit, we do have the our legal counsel online, and he has a kind of a time constraint. And the idea would be is Ms. Patterson will provide the first presentation, and then we'll go into questions from the committee members and to the legal counsel if there was any, and then so we can release him. So with that, Rochelle, please.
So I'm going to introduce the consultants from Bardol and Wells to go through the first part of the presentation. And like Director Peterson said, we do have Lutfi from BB&K, our law firm, to answer if there's any legal questions in between, only because he does have a time constraint. And then we will go into the second presentation, and that's from the from RDN, the ratepayer advocate. It'll be Michael DeGroot, I believe, from Barter and Wells, and we also have Doug Dove from Barter and Wells to go through the first presentation.
Thank you. Good evening. So next slide, please. So this is the presentation overview. I'm going to be going over the background and objectives of our study, talk about the study fee methodology, go over the fee calculation, and then answer any questions at the end. Next slide, please. So first, the background and objectives. Next slide. So Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency was created in January 2018 through the merger of three water agencies in the Santa Clarita Valley: Castaic Lake Water Agency, Newhall County Water District, and Valencia Water Company. And now SCV Water serves a population of approximately 273,000 people through about 70,000 retail water connections. And there are about 31,200 existing connections in the Valencia service area. Next slide. So this is the current Valencia customer base, and there's currently about 31,189 connections, and those vary from the smallest meter at 5/8 inch up to a big 12 inch meter. And we use the American Water Works Association standard meter equivalents based on the 1 inch meter. And so the total 1 inch meter equivalents of your system is 27,958. Next slide. So we projected out the Valencia customer base, and we're projecting your current number of customers at 31,189 will increase by projected 23,609 new customers. And so you'll have a total projected customer base in 20 years of 54,798, and a total projected 1 inch meter equivalence of 50,292. And this was projected based on the West Side Community's land use plan. Next slide. So what are capacity charges? The capacity fee is a one-time fee paid by new customers as a condition of development, and they're levied to recover costs for capacity in facilities that benefit growth. They're also collected for changes in property use that result in increased capacity needs. Next slide. So the purpose of the study update is that the Valencia service area is the only service area that does not have an existing capacity fee, and the Valencia service area has substantial planned new growth. So the goal of the study is to develop a Valencia service area capacity charge that's appropriate, legal, and fair. Next slide. So the key criteria for our fee is to comply with government code. We want to base it on industry standard methodologies and to recover the costs of existing facilities that benefit growth and in a way that's fair and equitable to existing and future customers. Next slide. So the legal framework regarding capacity fees is government code section 66013. And the key provision is that the fee shall not exceed the estimated reasonable cost of providing the service for which the fee or charge is imposed. So you can recover costs for existing facilities or future facilities. And capacity charges need to be segregated from other funds and only used for capital. So the fee methodology used to update the capacity fee here complies with these industry standards. Next slide. So I'm going to go over the study fee methodology. Next slide. So there's four steps that we applied here. Step one was to determine the cost of the facilities and assets for the fee recovery. Then step two is to identify the capacity of your system. Step three is to calculate the cost per unit of capacity. And step four is to apply costs per unit to the capacity needs of new development. Next slide. So our basic study approach here was to look at your existing water system assets, and that includes land, boosters, communications equipment, furniture and fixtures, hydrants, office warehouse building, reservoir tanks and wells, water mains and water treatment equipment. So these are kind of the main backbone infrastructure of your system that we included in the fee. Next slide. We excluded these other assets from the fee. They include vehicles, large tools and equipment, water meters, services, power operated equipment, stores equipment, and other intangibles. So our fee is really designed to recover the backbone infrastructure of the system. Next slide. So the cost recovery basis is the cost of these existing facilities escalated for construction cost inflation. And the fees are based on a replacement cost less depreciation in current dollars. We also excluded Valencia debt that's related to those facilities. When we projected the Valencia water system capacity, we estimated it based on the current 1-inch meter equivalents plus projected future development. And so the basic calculation is the existing system valuation divided by current plus future projected water system capacity. Next slide. And these are the outstanding debt that's associated with your assets. You've got a 2018A installment loan that had $26.7 million of outstanding principal, and the Valencia acquisition loan of about $58.5 million, which was the cost of SEVWA purchasing the system. So the total outstanding principal related to Valencia assets that are subtracted from the fee amounts to about $85.2 million. Next slide. So now I'm going to talk about the fee calculation. Next slide. So we calculated the value of your system based on the original cost, which was about $152 million. We escalated that based on construction cost inflation to $340 million, and then subtracted out depreciation. So the total value replacement cost less depreciation of your assets was about $141.4 million. And then we adjusted that for your outstanding debt issuance of $85.2 million. So the total asset valuation for the capacity fee amounted to $56.16 million. Next slide. And so we took the existing system asset value of $56.16 million and we divided that by the ultimate number of 1-inch meter equivalents of 50,292 to get a fee per 1-inch meter equivalent of $1,117. And we apply that to the industry standard AWWA meter ratios to get a fee that ranges from $670 for a 3/4-inch connection up to $96,000 approximately for a 12-inch meter. And that's it. Next slide. So now I'll answer any questions.
So we were going to ask if there's any
legal
questions that you may have for legal, since you may have to jump off.
You have a legal question? Go ahead.
I wanted to ask about the letter we received from Building Industry Association that questions the methodology for pricing, including there are questions about contributed capital in-track facilities and assets funded by grants. They said are those included? If they are, they believe that would be a problem. Let's see. So I guess that's the main question that they raise in their letter. Do you have a response to that?
Sure. And good evening, everybody. First off, I apologize. My camera is not on. I'm calling in from my phone. With respect to the letter, you know, we can prepare a more formal response, but, you know, just in brief, I have reviewed the study. I believe the methodology is sound. With respect to the way that facilities are funded, I agree that there could be issues to the extent that this is a capacity fee intended to fund growth. However, the purpose of this capacity fee is to ensure that future development pays their share of the existing asset value depreciated for net present value. So I believe that the methodology that that the agency has, you know, has been studied for the agency in the rate study is sound. And I don't believe that there is a significant merit with respect to the BIA letter. However, we did just receive it late in the afternoon, and I haven't had a chance to go back and discuss with the rate consultant.
Okay. And then I have a second question for you. You mentioned the word equity. So, and I'm trying to understand this in the lens that, you know, coming from a different agency where we did have connection fees. So we have a bunch of Valencia customers that didn't pay connection fees when they connected. And now we're asking the new customers to pay a portion, right, for the new, I'm trying to get this right, the new assets that will be required for them. They're going to pay for the new assets, but we have two classes of people that paid or are going to have to pay. So again, Newhall people paid, Santa Cruz people paid, there's some Valencia people that didn't pay, and then there's going to be these new Valencia people that are going to pay. Is there a problem with treating people differently?
Thank you. That's a great question. So I think one thing that's important to remember is that the existing Valencia customers have been paying for water service for years to their, you know, prior six of the predecessor agency, which means that they have been paying for the cost of facilities through their rates. And again, those weren't rates that went to SCV Water, but they were ostensibly designed to recover the cost of providing service to them. What new customers are being required to pay is the current value of the assets that they're buying into, which means it's not the full price. It's not the actual cost at the time of construction. It's the cost of the assets, taking into account any depreciation, any reduction in value based off of you know, the reduction in the useful life of the assets. So this is a pretty customary approach for buying into existing facilities. You know, it takes into account the fact that people are going to be able to use facilities that have been paid for through rates over some period of time. And it's, I do believe that it is a fair approach.
Okay. I'm sorry, I have one more. Because the value, mm-hmm. is the word value, but we're not including debt.
Right.
So why is that? Mm-hmm. I don't understand why if you sell your house and you have a mortgage on it.
Sure.
The value, there's the cost of the house and then the cash that you get. So why are they not paying for the debt that everybody's going to have to continue to pay for? Is that the logic? Is that in the rates? Is that what the thought is?
Yes, that there is a component in the ongoing rates to pay for debt service. And so these people that will be connecting are going to pay for that debt service as a part of their rates. And they'll pay for the portion of the debt service associated with, you know, what's left in the life of the project. If we were to require that they pay a portion of the debt as a part of the capacity fee, as well as the part of their ongoing rates, it could be seen to be kind of a double whammy, because they're paying, you know, at the outset, and then they're also paying as a part of their ongoing rates. So again, this is I think it's a fair approach. It's a pretty standard approach that, you know, if they're paying for the debt through their ongoing rates, once they connect to the system, then that's sufficient to cover their share of the debt.
Thank you.
Sure.
Anything
Yeah. Before we leave that topic too of your question, I believe that at one time customers in the Santa Clarita division weren't paying those charges as well because it was a private water company and then was purchased, and there was some time period where, you know, capacity charges would have had it been developed similar to what happened with Valencia. I couldn't pinpoint it, but that makes sense to me that that would be the case. And it may even be the case for portions of the new health service here. I'm not sure how far back that charge goes, but certainly putting Valencia on the same, you know, logical basis as other customers currently would achieve that.
Yeah, question for legal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I have a question for legal, but can I put it at the end? I'm going to do a little preface to it, I guess. First, I want to say thank you for the presentation. The explanations of the calculations is a lot to digest on the spot. So I guess in the future, if we can maybe have that information a little bit with more lead time, it would be great to be able to sit down and look at it a little bit more carefully and with more time. I think in general, I do think it's unfortunate that the agency has lost out on collecting retail capacity fees for Valencia since 2018, but I'm very glad that we are having this conversation now to rectify that. I did spend a significant amount of time talking to Ms. Patterson today to help me understand the history and the methodology better, and I'm really glad I did do that. Because at first glance, when you look at the retail capacity fees that are being proposed in this packet and compare it to the other divisions that have already established retail capacity fees and are collecting them, they are significantly lower. So the first question was, why are they significantly lower? And, you know, is that fair to our existing customers? So I just want to put out there key pieces of information that I learned that I think may be helpful to put out. Was it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong or misrepresent this in any way, Ms. Patterson, there's kind of two portions to the retail capacity fees. There's the buy-in fees part, and then there's the part that covers or goes along with the master plan fees, right, to cover the infrastructure for divisions that still have building that they're doing in the area. So my understanding was the Valencia division did not have a master plan as the other divisions do, and that the agency is asking developers to build their own water infrastructure going forward for new development, which is why there is no master plan portion of this retail capacity fee included. Am I saying that right? Okay. So these proposed fees are kind of a stepping stone until we can finish our master plan, which is due to be finished at the end of this year, at which time I think the vision is to create a unified retail capacity fee structure and facility capacity fee structure that will be equal for all the divisions, which I think is a great idea. And I would say we should do that as quickly as possible once we have all the tools to do that. And in the meantime, I definitely agree to the provision that says we need to do annual adjustments include the increasing costs of replacing assets as we go along. So the question I have that I got to in a very roundabout way is what assurances do we have or what do we have in writing with the builders or developers that says that they will be the ones who will build infrastructure in this division going forward? Because if that's an assumption that we're making for these proposed capacity fees, I just want to make sure that will be actually carried out and stuck to.
I'm sorry, may I interrupt for a second? I apologize. I just want to make sure these questions right now are for legal because he has to drop off, because we still have a portion of the presentation we need to handle and have public comment before we have discussion. So do we have any more questions for legal?
I mean, I think that was kind of directed to legal too.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
Engineering more. Okay. Okay. Engineering has an answer. Sorry.
We still have a presentation from the rapier advocate.
No, okay, let's go through the finish the presentation then.
Okay, so Erica, can you bring up?
Yes, let me bring up the other PowerPoint.
Anthony Ilowski. Sorry if I mispronounced your name, from RDN. He is our ratepayer advocate and has reviewed the study from Bartle and Wells, and he has a presentation to go through.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking the time today, especially the Finance Committee and members of the public that are here. Can you move to the next slide? My name is actually Anthony Ilowski, just for future reference if any comments are directed at me. I'm here as the ratepayer advocate, and this position was included in the bill that created SCV Water, SB 634. And basically, we're here to advocate and look out for customers' concerns, ratepayer concerns. Next slide. So I am with RDN, and a little background on RDN. We've been helping agencies with utility rate and fee setting across California since 1983. We've been working with SCV Water since 2019 as ratepayer advocate. Next slide, please. And we are currently in stage 4 of the fee setting process as outlined in the agency rules. We've reviewed the analysis done by Bartle Wells, developed recommendations, and provided a written report, which I believe has been on file with the agency for a little while now. And it includes our outcome on the directions that we gave. The next step 5, the board of directors will decide whether to initiate the recommended fees. Next slide, please. And as ratepayer advocate, we try to balance some competing concerns, which we believe affect agency customers. The first, and it's been mentioned already a couple times, is equity. Current customers to this point have been paying to have this extra capacity in the water system to accommodate growth within the Valencia service area. We believe it's only fair that new customers share some of the burden for that capacity that's been held in the water system. Also, new customer contributions can be used for asset replacement and repair, and that reduces the need for future rate increases. So generally speaking, higher capacity fees are good for current customers. Next slide. And while it is important for new customers to pay a fair price, there are some economic and legal concerns that balance out making the fees too high. First, if the fees are too high, it might hinder growth in the area, and that reduces the total amount of capacity fees that are collected. It also reduces the overall cost sharing when designing rates and revenue requirements. Generally speaking, again, a water system having more customers is usually better because of the economy of scale, more customers to share costs with. Additionally, as the consultants Bartle Wells mentioned, fees must adhere to California law, which means that fees cannot exceed the costs. Next slide, please. So generally, we did an overall analysis of the process that the consultant Bartle Wells used to compute the capacity fees. We agree with that they use the best methods for their study. For example, they used industry standards such as the AWWA meter ratios and state law when determining equivalent meters. The growth forecasts were consistent with published reports and reflect the most likely scenario based on our understanding of the information that's available. The final asset valuation, replacement cost minus depreciation, reflects the current value of the Valencia infrastructure. And the buy-in method used by Bartle Wells reflects the most equitable distribution of costs between the current and future customers, especially since there is an overall SCV water capacity fee system-wide, which is based on growth-related capital improvements. We did refine some of the recommendations throughout this study, and somewhere included in the final rate report. And so the next few slides, I'm going to describe the refinements that we proposed and how they were used by Bartle Wells. Next slide, please. First, we recommended that Bartle use a more targeted cost index, such as the Los Angeles Consumer Price Index, to increase the overall precision of the replacement cost. However, because the system-wide SCV water capacity fee uses the 20 city index, it's seen as consistent with the current methodology that's being used. And also the 20 city index is less volatile than the one that is in just the Los Angeles area. And so we deemed that the 20 city index was actually appropriate for this analysis, especially for projecting future asset values. Next slide, please. Next, we recommended that Bartlewells remove the outstanding debt principal. Current customers have actually pay this installment loan, the 2018A installment, and also the acquisition loan. The debt was issued to fund capital improvements in the Valencia service area. And so it was determined that we should remove this debt from the overall asset value. In the end report, the final report, we agreed that subtracting the outstanding debt improved the overall RF retail capacity fee design. And that recommendation was included in the final report. Next slide, please. And as was mentioned already again, we recommended that new fees, they actually increase based on the CPI increases through time in the future. This recommendation was also included in the final report, and this ensures that the current value of the system is captured each year of the assessment. Next slide, please. And finally, we recommend that these fees get reevaluated periodically, so that when new assets are replaced, that we capture the cost of the current value of the system. A lot of the infrastructure is currently fully depreciated. So as that gets replaced, it will increase the overall value of the system and the capacity that's held within it. Finally, next slide, please. Just to summarize, we found that the retail capacity fees are fair and defensible, and we believe that the agency should implement them as designed. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. And you can open it up to director questions.
All right.
Actually,
public comment first.
Right. Public comment first. Yes.
Yes, we do have public comment tonight. Cam Noltemeyer, you may take the podium.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Cam Noltemeyer. Yes, I found that rather amusing. We have been here since before the city was even formed. And we paid our dues already on Valencia because we had somebody that had put out a lot of money for setting it up. And we had the Valencia Water Company. And we paid that off. So as far as I'm concerned, we've paid all we're ever going to pay. And that's what was stated at that time. This is building it for the developers. And you want everybody that will ever live there pay for it for them. That's what this comes down very simply. If you do an analysis. And I used to do this when I was working for many years. And when I see something like that, it really angers me because you're not including what the people that are already there have paid. And we paid that for many, many years. And now you're setting up a saying, well, gee, this is going to be so beneficial. The only one it's beneficial for are the developers. Let the developers pay to have it put in. It's very simple. That's the way it used to be. Now you want to set up a wonderful system, going system. Oh, you used of what? What are you thinking? If they need the water for their developments, they should pay. You've got it done. You've made it a desirable area. When they come in, what you want to do is have all the ratepayers pay for a huge benefit to set up for developers. It's as simple as that. It's plain. And I sit back there and I'm going, what are they thinking? Like I said, we've been sitting through this for many, many, many years. And we had to pay off the first one. But why isn't it being set up now that way? What you want to do is just pay for everything for the developers so it can be built before they build and they get all the profit from it. And if you can explain why that isn't exactly what you're doing, I would like to hear something like that from someone sitting up here. I have yet to hear any common sense with regard to this.
Thank you. Your comment is complete.
Director Colley, go ahead.
So appreciate Ms. Noltmeyer, you're inviting somebody up here to explain to you where you might be in error. This discussion is intended to do the exact opposite of what you suggest. So the fees that we are talking about will be levied on developers. Currently, they are paying nothing. And the idea would be to have them pay something. The fees we're discussing will not be levied on current homeowners. So I think it's important to say that we're doing the exact opposite of what you suggested.
I also have some other.
We have more public comment. Thank you, Director Colley. Do you have more public comment, Erica?
No other public comment at this time.
Well, we do have two letters that were submitted to Erica this afternoon. One from the Building Industry Association of Southern California, and another one from the Santa Clarita Valley Chamber of Commerce. Director Gutzeit kind of relayed some of the items that were already in the building industry letter. Both of them basically asking us to, as a committee, to postpone or table this item for a future meeting so that they can further study the rates. With that, any further comment before I open up to the board of directors? Nope. Okay. Go ahead, Director Colley.
Could we go back to the ratepayer advocate slides 4 and 5? Is that possible?
Just give me a moment to pull it back up.
I appreciate it. I wasn't sure if I should interrupt the flow on 4 and 5 or not. I never know which would be the preference.
That's slide 4.
Yeah, right? That's slide 4. That was perfect. When it was there. Perfect. Thanks. It doesn't want to stay.
It's finicky. Sorry about that.
Okay. So it looks to me like the 2, 3, and 4 on this slide are all being done tonight. Is that the ratepayer advocate's understanding? Because I really haven't. Well, we didn't have a full opportunity last month to discuss this, although I tried. But it looks to me like number 2 is happening tonight for the first time. Is that not true?
In my understanding, there was a report developed and there was comments given on the report, and then the ratepayer advocate myself reviewed the recommendations of the report and gave further comments. And then a draft final report was provided. And now we're reviewing that independent written analysis and that draft report that was final at stage 4.
Okay. So I must have, I know I've missed some meetings, but I try to read the packets. And so, okay. So, others on the committee suggest that number two has not happened before tonight. I think is that fair? Okay, so we're doing two, three, and four. And the reason I bring this up is that I have oftentimes objected to being brought as a board member what I always term a baked cake. Dan used to use that term a lot, and I really kind of liked it. I would prefer that when we're doing things that we actually do something like this flow chart, where the members of the board are allotted some time before we're expected to just rubber stamp something, because I have plenty of concerns with this, and I would prefer to raise my concerns much earlier in the process, but I don't see where I had an opportunity. So in the future, at least, if we could actually look at this flowchart and try to do something like this over a period of time and not have in a five-step process, three steps in a single night. So if we could go to slide number five, I'd appreciate it. So how many treatment plants does Valencia Water Company have or had? How many did they bring to the table, so to speak? Is somebody tell me that? I guess, Mr. Stone, do you know if Valencia Water Company had any treatment plants that they brought with them, so to speak?
You're talking about like...
Well, I have a 30-year-old treatment plant with 50 years of lifespan here on this slide. Right. And we're talking about Valencia's infrastructure.
So Valencia doesn't have any surface treatment plants. Those would have been covered under the facility capacity fee.
That's what I thought. Okay.
For Castaic. The hesitation is the V201 perchlorate treatment, which has been inactive because of the VOCs that showed up, and that was a Valencia well. But it's
okay. I was trying to find
that was really where you were going with the question.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to find a 30-year-old treatment plant that Valencia Water Company brought with them.
I'm assuming the advocate was using that as an illustrative set of numbers. He could probably
speak okay. to that. Well, all right. So. All right. I looked at that and tried to figure out where that fit into this discussion. So this is a hypothetical water company, nothing.
I think the concept is they look at the valuation of assets and they look at the remaining life, and they look at what it would cost to replace those and then depreciate that for the fact that it doesn't have its full remaining life.
Okay, so this is a hypothetical, not a...
Yeah, it's an illustrative concept
there. Okay, all right. That's all I had on that presentation. I have other concerns, but I don't know if I don't want to hog the mic entirely here.
Go ahead, Director Gusite.
And to be clear, I have no other questions, I don't think, for legal. I enjoyed the ratepayer advocate presentation. I especially found that very clear, but the first one was helpful too. And I agree with Director Armitage, it would be good to get them earlier so we could look at it. But just to clarify, and what I want to make sure I understand it, I wish we could write it down. Facility capacity fees pay for the whole valley. So when a developer is paying a facility capacity fee, they're paying for the treatment plants, they're paying different large things.
Yeah.
As opposed to this is just a service area specific.
Right. And that to stuff. Some degree, and we probably would have developed it differently had we been consolidated from the beginning. Right. So historically, Castaic Lake handled the two treatment plants, the large regional distribution system, some regional emergency storage, and those facilities are covered in what's called the FCF or facility capacity fee. And those are, again, you said for the whole valley, that's true, although we have three WASA areas that we parcel things into, but it's all proportioned out between those regions and what's existing versus planned development to determine the apportionment of those costs.
Right.
So I was going to bring that up when you made the, or when Ms. Noltmeyer made the comment about supply. Supply is also in that FCF. So mm-hmm. purchasing into new supply investments is in that FCF mm-hmm. For imported supply.
Mm-hmm.
So water banking programs, the Rosedale Rio Bravo purchase, to the extent it's not funded by a developer. And so that's how that works. And then you're correct. The each retailer, except Valencia, at the time of the consolidation, had its own connection fees. And in the example of Newhall, there were multiple fees there because Newhall had multiple service areas. Mm-hmm. So they looked at those as kind of economic units when they did those fees. So at some point, the hope would be to unify that into an overall retail fee, and perhaps even an overall, you know,
right.
everything, everywhere, all at once,
right.
Capacity fee.
That was my next
question. That'll take a little time.
Statement. Yeah. So when we have our master plan, will that lead to a single rate? Or was that a single retail capacity fee and then still we would have the facility capacity fee? What's the thought on
that? I mean, I think there are options on that path. Okay. We'd want to look at, it really would probably depend on whether there's some value in doing them separately and sequentially or doing them all at the same time. We'd probably want to look through and, you know, look for any historically difficult issues that might come up when you kind of look at the basis for those fees.
Okay. Just because I would like to see us continue to move towards, you know, not going back and referring to the Valencia area, the Newhall area, the Santa Cruz area. If we had, I mean, again, what, I guess what's in a name, right? You could call them WASAs like we did at Newhall if they're economically different for a reason, but so it sounds like the plan is that we will be simplifying this down the road and this is a interim step, hopefully.
Yeah. And I think we kind of covered that at the beginning of this process. And I know Director Cawley was at that meeting because he was advocating on getting it done as fast as we could at the time. I think I was sitting in a parking lot in Tulare on my way up to Sacramento when I was listening in on that meeting. And that was kind of the kickoff of this study. And that was discussed at the time that this would get something in place. We want it to be, you know, reasonable and equitable. And once we get the master plan done and we have an opportunity to kind of look at how that affects the overall system, we could look at moving to consolidated fee either through the update of the retail and then folding in FCF at its next update or updating them all. It really just depends on how long it takes and, you know, whether we make it too complicated by doing it all at once or or not.
Okay. And last question, as far as timing, I know that we didn't talk about it. Well, it was pulled last month, at least the last meeting I was at on this topic, because there was a stakeholder meeting happening the day before. But the Chamber of Commerce says they request a stakeholder meeting. Were they included in the stakeholder meeting? They just want another round of comments or what is that about?
They were. We had actually had two stakeholder meetings.
Okay.
So in January or February, we had one and that was to go over the methodology for the report. And the second one was to actually talk about the numbers, the whole report. So the first presentation that you saw from Bartle Wells, that's the same presentation that the stakeholders
saw. So they did see it.
Or it was made available had they been here.
Okay. But it was available. And okay. And then what is our required timing? Is there a reason that we want to do this tonight and move it to the board? Are you trying to get it done by a fiscal year start or?
Well, we would like to have it done right away, but fiscal year start would be a good time to start it.
So July 1st. Okay. Oh, yes, please.
We also have some staff considerations. It does take us a while to implement some of the fees, make sure we are updating the quotes we've already provided to developers. We have a computer system to making sure that those quotes and those fees are coming in accurately. So we typically like at least 30 days for that. If not a little bit more would be nice, because we have to kind of make sure everything is in order. We don't want to miscollect the amount of fees we have. Mm-hmm. So with that understanding, we don't want to delay too far, because we still want to have an official fee and start the process of getting it implemented. Okay. Going forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And then there's just the revenue loss.
Right.
As well. But I think we've tried to work with, you know, we did delay this a month to make sure there was time to review the report. We made that known in response to their request promptly. A little surprised that they're asking for more time. I thought this was enough time, but you know, there is a little time between now and the board when the board would consider this. And I think the questions that they put in the letter were addressed directly tonight by the rate advocate and council. But if there are additional questions, you know, to the extent, it would have been great for them to come tonight and ask those questions, but if they want to submit additional questions in advance of the board meeting, it would be great to get them, like, not at 4:30, but sooner, so we could be responsive. I haven't pulled staff on our availability to have another stakeholder meeting. I don't think we would brush them off from that if we can make that happen, and if there's substantive things we could talk about, but I feel like we're on fairly good ground with this, unless they've come up with something. And one of the items that was raised in the BIA letter, we took out ourselves. That's one of the reasons we, you know, delayed the release of the report, was to address that question. So anyway, I feel like we're being responsive.
No, May 2nd.
And I don't know if you want me to answer Kathy Director Armitage's question from earlier.
A weighted explanation.
Yeah. So the developers are definitely responsible for their own facilities on site. They start off with notification to them during their availability letter process. When they first let us know that there is a development, we will specify that they will be building all of their own facilities. This is across the valley. We actually do that. All of the developers are responsible for their own facilities. We also further define that when we do a subarea master plan. So in the case of Five Point, they did a subarea master plan, which defined the sizes of their facility, size of the pump station, size of the tanks, all the pipelines, where they're going to go in general parameters in the street, and what size they're going to be to make sure we can meet their service parameters. That sets the condition. They have to build to that standard so that we can meet their demands of their project, and then they have to dedicate all of those pipelines to us. Same with the tanks and pump stations, reservoirs. And then when we pull a contract and agreement with them and they're ready to build, they have to bond for all of those facilities, meaning they have to put up money or credit in line that if they were to leave, we could finish the facilities still at their expense. So we have protections in place to ensure that they would do that. Hopefully that answers that question.
I'm trying to finish your question.
No, thank you. So I appreciate that. So follow up to that is, I know in the past we've had discussions about having to upsize things or having to build an additional reservoir to meet requirements for fire safety standards. So I guess I'm want to ask that if those are, if we have to meet certain standards for safety, why are we having to pay the difference for some of that? Why isn't that included in their costs that they're putting out as they develop?
So for Five Point specifically, we haven't done that. The ones that we have for emergency storage in that area is actually under the FCF fee. So not part of this fee, not included as an expansion or part of that fee that we would calculate. It's part of the expansion fee related to the FCF, and they do have to pay that portion. That contributes to that facility. In other facilities, in other areas where we do a participation for the, as an example, the Dean Zone, which we are participating in upsizing to recover additional storage for that area, there's multiple reasons why that can happen over time. The development can become increase in density in certain areas. You can have change in standards. You can also have change in calculation on how the amount of water each home is going to take, or the size or demand of that system. So it fluctuates over time a little bit. We try to use the best available information and the most current standards to calculate how much demand we would need. If for some reason in the future, the fire demand for the entire Mission Village zone in Five Point were to increase, then we would have to find a way to also increase. A lot of times some of that can be grandfathered in, but we do try to make sure we're meeting the demands of the area. A lot of times that's also additional emergency storage or additional storage that comes up that may switch from a two-day average storage that you're trying to do to a three-day average storage. And you can imagine that would change your storage and pumping criteria that we would try to compensate for as we move forward. There's also a loss in storage as we move with new regulations such as seismic retrofit of steel tanks. We now have more freeboard required for those tanks, and therefore some of our available storage per design has been lost, and we have to make up for that.
Okay, thank you. And I guess I'd still like to see where we have it in writing that the developers have to pay for their stuff going forward. If you could just point that out to me or show me where it is in writing, that would make me feel
we'll send
a little
you some availability letters and everything else.
That sounds good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And then I have a comment about the ratepayers, the ratepayer advocate. Do you want me to wait on that until after Director Cawley's spoken?
Go ahead.
So my question is, when a developer is developing a new tract, I'm assuming they put in hydrants. Is that a, I'm assuming when I look at these, the hydrants, we're talking about fire hydrants. Is that?
Yes. Fire hydrants and fire service runs, right?
Okay. And so they put in new hydrants into their development, and I think this is an example of something where one of these letters kind of brings up an issue. They're buying into all of the used hydrants all over elsewhere, and yet they're paying full freight on the brand new hydrant in front of the houses that they build that would service the houses they build. And they're not going to use in any way, shape, or form the hydrants 2 miles over there. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, the fire hydrants are part of the service that we included in the cost for reimbursement. Moving to their pipeline, we don't typically put in set stretches of pipeline without fire hydrants or fire service along the way. So we did evaluate that as if it were part of the standard design of that system as a backbone system. We did remove laterals and fire service laterals that would be specific to a single property. But for us, fire hydrants, valves, all of the system that you would install to reach them, air vacs and blow-offs included, which several of our fire hydrants also operate as blow-offs, and so therefore work as a functional tool of the pipeline, we included all of those as part of the evaluation.
Okay. So yeah, the comment I have is that the letters that we have here in front of us do have what I think is a legitimate concern, as exampled here, of the fire hydrants, that they're paying full freight for the brand new fire hydrant they get no credit for, and they're having to buy into somebody else's old used junk fire hydrant that's only worth a quarter of its original value, that they now have to buy into that. And so the developers are objecting to that. And I think in that case, it's kind of legitimate. And let me make a comment here. Never mind. No, I'll make it like later. I promise to make this a linear discussion. So sorry. Trying.
Yeah, more.
I do have just a comment and very quick question for the ratepayer advocate. Can I do that now?
Yes, go ahead.
So first of all, thank you to Mr. Oleski as our ratepayer advocate. It's a pleasure to meet you, because I know we've had the benefit of the services of Ms. Keto in the past, who I've always enjoyed listening to her reports and appreciated them. So thank you to you also for your written report and your presentation today. One question I have is, Was there a recommendation that you made that was not included or implemented in your report?
Beyond the ones that we discussed in the presentation, there were no additional recommendations. The only one that was not included was using the targeted CPI index, and we determined that overall using the 20 city index was more appropriate for the current study.
Okay, thank you for answering that. And I just want to say to the agency thing, I know you it was required under the law to have the ratepayer advocate, at least for a period of time, but I just think it's a fabulous resource for us. And as the people up here have to make decisions, I think it's a good additional voice to have and perspective to have as we make these decisions. So very much appreciated. And I would even say, I would like to see us continue to have a ratepayer advocate even beyond the time of which we're required to have one. I think it's a benefit that we should continue to use. So thank you.
Thank you.
Director, okay, Vice President Gusait.
Like that is, I thought that was a selling point that it was quick. Two things. First of all, before I forget, the ratepayer advocate, by the way, is available to any ratepayers, including the Chamber of Commerce and BIA. If they have questions, they are able to contact them directly for, you know, maybe differently worded interpretations or comparison to other areas. So the ratepayer advocate is a very good service and is not just for the board, but also for any ratepayer to work with. And then just on the, Director Colley made the comment that they were paying full freight on old hydrants. And I thought I saw in the presentation that there was some depreciation in there. So they're not paying full. If they paid $10,000 for a hydrant 20 years ago, they're not paying another $10,000 on that hydrant. They're paying I said it better the first time, but I saw you nodding your head.
Yeah, it's depreciated.
It's not full freight on the old stuff. So they paid to build it originally. That's what you were talking with Director Armitage, like the original infrastructure that you make them put in, they pay to build it. And then this connect, and then those customers are also paying their rates for capital replacement, upgrades, et cetera, in that community. And then these new people coming in are buying part of that service with this retail connection fee. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, it's fairly good. I think the one key point is to say that they are depreciated value of the assets.
Right.
So that your assets over time obviously depreciate, and you, in order to feed the service up to the development, all of that pipeline and infrastructure that was installed, it benefits that development. They don't have to install it to get up to their site.
Right.
So they buy into that system on whatever the value is in today's dollars.
Right. Okay. So yeah, I just wanted to correct that full freight. Thank you.
So yeah, I think you're right. I did misspeak. They're paying full freight on the brand new that are sitting in front of the houses of the brand new development, that they're paying the full amount, brand new, non-depreciated, whatever it costs. The depreciated stuff, they're just paying some prorated and depreciated part for something they will not use. This item just leaves me all kinds of conflicted, because I absolutely agree with staff that time is of the essence. Right now we're letting folks come in for free. As general manager pointed out, I was advocating moving forward with this with great haste or as much as we could. My another comment I've got is it's very unfortunate that the folks that are sending the letters aren't here tonight, because I would very much like to hear their more detailed comments and concerns. The letters don't really provide me enough detail to understand all the concerns they might have. So I wish that they would have engaged in the committee process and come and allowed me to, I mean, I would have asked them questions and They wouldn't have, because I'm asking them questions, wouldn't have necessarily been able to, or been required to stay within the 3 minutes, I would hope. Anyway, a question, I think probably more rhetorical than actual, but if 50,000 one-inch equivalent meters were attached to the Valencia system today, could that Valencia system handle 50,000 one-inch meters? And I'm going to assume the answer is no.
The answer is no.
Okay. So by using the denominator of 50,200 and something, I think it was, in this calculation, we make a huge error. The next meter that goes in, the next one-inch meter, brings it to 27,000 and 28,000 or something. I don't know. Brings it closer to 28,000 one-inch equivalent meters. And that is what the divisor in this formula should have been. It makes no sense unless we have the system already built for the 50,000 and there's not going to be any changes to use that 50,000 number in the denominator. So yeah, of course the fee is incredibly low because we have pretended that there'll be no improvements and no additional investments made. We've also pretended that there'll be none of the debt ever paid off. And so the developer today is given credit for things which just aren't there. So the logic in here, I think I said last month, I'm very much an advocate of the buy-in approach. I've been trying to get there on the facility capacity fees for 20 years and haven't gotten there. I'm an advocate of that approach, but the approach needs to be thought through a little more carefully. So, you know, that artificially making the number very, very low by using a very, very large denominator makes no sense to me. I look at some of these numbers, the depreciation of the warehouse building in the office, if the replacement cost of a commercial building in this valley, if the replacement cost was $5 million, nobody would sell such a building for $2.3 million. The value of that building is going to be much, much closer to its replacement cost. So that makes no sense to me to depreciate a building in that particular building by 55%. And that doesn't make any sense at all. That's a fiction that, you know, sell it to me for that. I'll make a lot of money. I'll resell it for a lot more. So I don't think a lot of these numbers, the depreciated value, are well tied into reality. And I would have preferred that they be adjusted accordingly. And then I also am concerned about some of the things that we have studies. I know Valencia did quite a bit of study work, and those have value. Valencia brought a lot of things of value to this agency that I think aren't accounted for in this study. So last month I brought up some of these concerns, and I haven't you know, I don't see any of them having been addressed. I don't see, you know, any real progress on making these numbers better. I would have liked to have had a better study done, frankly. And I guess I'll circle back to the beginning. I'm very conflicted because I would like to have this done now, but voting yes on this today is to say that I agree with the analysis that's been done, and I simply don't. I think that in some ways the developers are being mistreated, and in some ways I think they're being given a gift that they don't deserve. So, and I'm not sure, you know, that those two would wash, so to speak, and equate and bring us back to that same number. I kind of doubt it, as a matter of fact. Thanks.
Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. I think you bring up interesting questions and points. And so I'm wondering, since we have our additional resources here with us joining by Zoom, if Mr. DeGroote and Mr. Olesky can speak to the question that Director Colley has in terms of using a different denominator. And then perhaps if you could elaborate a little bit more on which assets you thought got left out of the valuation, and if they could speak to that as well.
Yeah, so regarding the capacity of the system, we think it's much more defensible to include the growth that you know is coming into the system. And, you know, it's a legitimate method to just use the existing capacity, but that's much more, would be much more appropriate in a service area that was not growing, or a service area that was stagnating. Such as one customer joining and one customer leaving, you have the same capacity. But when we know that you have so much growth that's coming in, we need to take into account. And the reason is because you would end up with an inequity where the initial customers that connect, the first customers that connect, would pay a disproportionate amount more than the last customer to connect, because you would have to constantly adjust the capacity higher and higher as new customers connect, which would bring the fee down. And we think that this is a much more proportional way to handle that fee calculation. I think one could argue that unless you were constantly adjusting your fee, that you would be over collecting capacity revenues because your denominator would be growing substantially over time.
Yeah, I have a question, a comment to follow up. This is Doug Dove with Bartle Wells. The hydrants, you know, that's a very important part of the system and the backbone. And it's used for flushing the system, and it's used, you know, there's a lot of uses besides fighting fires. So we thought about hydrants, and you know, we want to be as fair as possible to the developers. And we thought about hydrants, and we really thought they deserve to be included in the valuation of the backbone system. As far as the, you know, the denominator used in the buy-in calculation, we use the build-out number of capacity. And we felt that was appropriate because, you know, the system that you have now is going to be added to, and those additions are going to be paid for by developers. And as, you know, time goes on, you'll be doing more and more of these capacity fee studies, maybe every 5-10 years. And those will be added into the existing assets. But for right now, we feel it's more fair to allocate the existing value of the system to the build out capacity rather than to allocated based on the current capacity, as Michael explained.
And if I can explain that a little bit more, I'd like to contribute to that. You know, following along with Director Colley, what you said, that yes, we don't have enough capacity in the system to serve 50,000 one-inch meters. The developers are required to build all of their own facilities in order to serve that amount, and that includes their storage and pump station. But without the existing infrastructure, they would not be able to build any of their own infrastructure to serve their system, or they'd have to pay a significant and much higher today current value to install those pipelines to a reasonable point, including fire hydrants, blow-offs, air vacs, and all these system components that they are buying into. So as a development, they need to buy in, and as a equity cost, we include all of their future homes so that it's spread across equally. The existing customers and the future customers all have an equal share in the system that is currently existing. So that's the way I understand these capacities go and the way we had discussed it with Bartle Wells on that item.
So okay, when three different people give me different arguments on different things and whatnot, puts me quite at disadvantage. I'm trying to keep up mentally with all this. And so if we're going to have a kind of a discussion, it's easier for me if one person provides me one input and one on one item. So forgive me if I'm a little bit scattered here. So my point on hydrants is and was, I think, still legitimate. I guess I'll preface this with, I'm envisioning most of the money we collect are going to come from developers who are developing raw land and putting in streets and pipes and all that good stuff on raw land. And occasionally, of course, we're going to get money from somebody who has a lot on a street that has many houses around it. It's just an empty lot. And they will be buying in. And that person legitimately would probably need to buy into the fire hydrant that's down the street that would service their house. But in the case of a developer who is developing an entire tract or a whole new street, he's putting in fire hydrants that, as we pointed out, could be used for flushing and blow-offs. And the fire hydrant that is 10 years old, that is 2 miles away or 10 miles away, would not flush any pipe that he would be concerned about, would not service a fire on any house that he is concerned about. And so he is buying a new fire hydrant, paying full freight on the one on that street, and he is buying in into a depreciated fire hydrant that he doesn't need or want that I know of. I don't know what, if it was 2 miles down the road, I don't see how it could possibly serve his interests or the homeowner's interest that is that in that new house. So I'm not sure that I've heard any argument that suggests that a developer who is developing a new development, raw land, should be buying both brand new fire hydrants and paying full freight for those brand new fire hydrants and also buying into the depreciated. So I guess I'm guilty in some part because the way we structure our conversations that I go on and whatnot. So I will stop at that point and ask if anybody can tell me why it would make sense for a developer who's developing a brand new street to pay for fire hydrants for that street and to be buying into the depreciation value of old fire hydrants miles away.
I think I can answer that. I think we've touched on it, and I know Doug Dove touched on it as well, that the fire hydrants are viewed as an essential part of the backbone of the system. They're done for flushings as well as air vacs and blow-offs and utilized to maintain that system. And so the value to that developer is not only are they getting pipeline, they're getting water quality and maintenance of that pipeline and the water supply to their development. if they don't include the fire hydrants and you don't consider that essential part of the system, then they would not have that same water quality delivered to their development because we wouldn't be able to maintain that system. For us, fire hydrants are more than just a pertinence that serves one or two homes or the 10 homes that are surrounded within the 350 feet. They are essential for the maintenance of that actual pipeline. We use them to flush. We use them for beyond firefighting. So we don't include services. We don't include fire services. We don't include property-specific items. But for us as the water system purveyors, we believe that the fire hydrants are an essential part of that system.
Okay, so then perhaps I ought to ask if then if the argument shouldn't be made the other way. These brand new fire hydrants that are being brought in by the developer that now service everybody, should they not somehow be credited them with that investment? Because they're providing something, as I understand you saying, that now helps everybody in the valley, that fire hydrant on their street. So if that's true, why would we not credit them the value of that brand new fire hydrant?
So we don't have an expansion component of our capacity fee. This is buy-in only on this capacity fee. The other areas do have an expansion component and can be considered as to whether or not developers would have a reduction. I think they've done that in the past. But for this particular capacity fee, we're looking at the buy-in fee only. The fire hydrants as part of the development, as we mentioned earlier, developers are responsible for all the facilities of their development in full. That includes the reservoirs, pump stations. In theory, those reservoirs could backfeed. We could utilize those for other areas, but for this development and the way we look at these fees and the buy-in to the existing system, we don't factor any of those in for contribution back to the rest of the system. Once it is an entire system and been dedicated to us and we reevaluate the capacity fees, that will be a consideration as a buy-in to that system.
Okay, I think I've made my point that this analysis is pretty darn weak. As you point out, there are other things besides just fire hydrants that could conceivably serve others. You know, somebody bringing in a new tank might well be of significant value to the rest of the valley and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think that only reinforces in my mind the analysis here is not complete. And I would much prefer that the analysis be more careful, more thorough, more fair. So I don't see that this is, I am not convinced yet that this analysis is, defensible and fair and reasonable. So thank you.
Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you.
So
we had kind of two issues floating around, fire hydrants and then the denominator issue. And so I just want to follow up one more thing on the whole denominator issue to kind of finish that part. That's okay. I will. So thank you for the explanation that you gave in response, but I have a follow-up question to that. So the recommendation in the report is to update the retail capacity fee annually to reflect the increasing cost. So that makes me wonder, why could we not update the current denominator, the capacity in the denominator at the same time? Because if build-up doesn't happen as planned, then we're using assumptions or calculations in the assumption that don't necessarily hold true. So I guess my question is it sounded like there was wiggle room, like we could, I don't know that you would recommend it, but if we think about when we update each year, then specifically looking at that number as well for the denominator. I hope my question's clear. Sorry.
I don't know if Mr. DeGroot wanted to cover that, or if you want me to try to tackle that.
Yeah, so I think in general, the methodology is not as defensible when you are just using the existing capacity. And so I think it does open us up to greater legal challenge. And there is a 120-day statute of limitations when you pass a capacity fee. And so your fee, if you elected to adopt a new fee every year, would be open to legal challenge. So that's something to think about, as well as the administrative effort to update that fee annually. But in general, we think that when we do these studies, do our best to identify the capacity associated with the assets. And we know, very confident that this growth will be coming through. And so I think the most equitable way to recover these costs would be to use the build out capacity as a denominator.
And just to be clear, each year, for let's say 5 to 10 years, the fee would just be indexed. We wouldn't, go back and redo the whole fee, because that's expensive. It would be indexed for a period, and then a full study would be done to update it.
Thank you for that clarification. That was helpful.
Vice President Gutzeit, go ahead.
I just want to add that, listening to all the comments, it's clear that we need something defensible and logical. And I went through this with the consolidation, many, many different things you can count and recount and try to predict, et cetera. But at the end of the day, I look at that we have an expert that does this all the time. And we have a ratepayer advocate who has looked at rates in many areas and is looking for best management practices in setting the rates. And finally, we have methods endorsed by the American Water Works Association and presented in their water rate manual. I think if we're going to pick a path, we should pick a path that has been thoroughly vetted and not expose us to liability and be as fair and legally defensible as possible. So that's kind of my feeling at the end of all of this is that we did a lot of work on it, and we do need something.
I have not said anything so far, but I would just submit to you, Director Colley, that fire hydrants are really part of the system, no matter where they're at. And the reason is because the agency's purpose is to provide fire service to all its customers, no matter where it's at. And the insurance there's an insurance bureau out there that reviews how those fire hydrants are taken care of. And they're basically part of the system, and it's an ownership that we have to deal with. So they should be involved in the buy-in of the system, totally. And the methodologies that have been proposed here are very reasonable to me also. As an engineer that's done this for a number of years prior to this gig, if you want to call it that, is that I think it's very reasonable, as Director, as Vice President Gutzeit points out, it is defensible. What I've seen in over the years in the connection fee wars, if you want to call it that, is that we have to have a defensible position based upon what's our job to do. So with that, I would propose that we submit this to the board at the May 1st May meeting and for the consideration by them. I'll agree. And Director Colley?
I'm going to vote no.
Yeah, I'll vote no. Okay.
Director Armstrong?
Yeah. I'm okay with moving it to the full board.
Yeah. All right. With that, let me move on to item four, which will be presented by Rochelle Patterson, and it's a review and recommended approval of the resolution adopting the 23-24 and 24-25 annual biennial budget.
Okay. So I'd just like to thank Anthony and Michael and Doug, if they're still on the line. And we'll see you again on May 2nd.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so here we go. Our long presentation. All right, go ahead. Next slide. So this is our third biennial budget for SCV Water. And as with our last budget cycle, staff will be seeking board approval for the first year, the fiscal year 23-24 spending plan, and conditionally approve the fiscal year 24-25 spending plan. This time next year, staff will be reviewing the second year spending plan and determine if it needs to be updated and amended. We have utilized the adopted rate plan. We have staffing levels at 242, and we have funding for our state mandates and projects such as PFAS and for our strategic goals and objectives. Next slide. There are major components of our budget. We have operating and other revenues, so our water sales revenues, all of our water sales we have from our customers. Property tax, this is for our operating capital budget, just the 1% portion of our property tax, and other revenues, which could be grant reimbursements, as well as interest earnings, and some laboratory revenues and communication lease revenues. And then on operating expenses, we have our general operating expenses, our debt service, and our PAYGO capital that has been funded by our revenue sources. Next slide. So the other components that are included, but not part of the operating plan, is the debt-funded CIP that is funded by either bond proceeds and coming up potentially WIFIA financing. We also have our state water contract fund. There is a slide in this presentation, as well as in your budget packet, that shows the revenues, which is primarily property tax and interest. That's the ad valorem tax rate, and then expenses for the state water contract. We also have our capacity fees. Just for simplicity, we still called it regional, which is the facility capacity fees, and then retail, which is the retail capacity fees. Next slide. So we had some key assumptions. Our revenue projections from our cost of service. We projected the account growth that was consistent with the cost of service study. We assumed a normal year for sales volumes, and we accounted for some conservation guidelines. So built into the cost of service was an additional 5% conservation through the five-year period to get us to 30% by 2025. And fiscal year 22-23 budget starts with our current operating conditions. And then we add together our 23-24 budget as our starting points. So we have our operation expenses. They have increased this year, partially due to the debt service. We have technology services that have increased, treatment chemicals, some additional fleet costs, water resources, and sustainability initiatives. We also have included the 6.5 revenue increase as outlined in the cost of service. And just to note that for budget purposes, we also reduced the residential water sales by $100,000 for the pilot ratepayer assistance program which will be discussed tomorrow. If we need to put that back in, we can, but for the budget purposes, we have went ahead and allocated that. And there's no change to the existing standard of service. Next slide. So this just shows our that our budget is balanced. We have our cash budget starts with our beginning cash balance, which is added to the cash inflows to get the cash available. Our cash outflows for this period are then subtracted to calculate the ending cash balance. This is shown in more detail in the financial summary section, which we call the pro forma, and that's on page 215 and 216 of your packet. So in fiscal year 23-24, we have a balanced budget of $155.5 million, which is our inflows. We have water sales, property tax, and other revenue sources, and $155.5 million of outflows, which is our departmental operating expenses, our debt service, and the portion of PAYGO that is able to be funded by our inflows. And in fiscal year 24-25, the inflows are expected to be $159 million from all revenue sources and $159 million for all outflows, which again is the departmental expense, debt service, and the portion of PAYGO that is funded by all our revenue sources. The funds available for PAYGO, as we see here in the fiscal year 23-24 proposed budget, is about $18.1 million. And then in fiscal year 24-25, about $15.8 million. Next slide. So our this is our proposed budget revenue and the components. On page 197 of the packet, you'll see that there's a 4.7% increase in total revenue sources from the fiscal year 22-23 adopted budget. And in fiscal year 24-25, revenues are projected to increase by about 2.3% over the fiscal year 23-24 proposed budget. Water sales comes from the adopted rate study, which includes the planned 6.5% revenue increase, a small percentage of growth, and includes the additional conservation reduction to meet the reduction goals as compared to our previous goal of 20% by 2020. Property tax is projected to be calculated by a trend that goes back more than a decade, which includes periods of drought and recession to forecast future years. The assumption is that property tax will increase by 2.3% in each year, and in fiscal year 23-24 is projected at about $31 million. And in fiscal year 24-25 at about $31.7 million. We have facility retail capacity fees. They're projected at about $1.6 million in fiscal year 23-24 and approximately $2 million in fiscal year 24-25. This projection is based on our engineer's estimate of development over the next two fiscal years. Miscellaneous revenue includes communication leases, rental income, investment, and laboratory revenues. The most significant change in this revenue line item is the projection of investment earnings. When we developed our last biennial budget for fiscal year 22 and 23, our investment earnings, which also includes our liquid assets in LAIF and LACPIF, averaged less than 1%, most times less than 0.5%. With a change in market and with the addition of our investment advisor firm, our long-term weighted average earnings rate for fiscal year 23-24 is 3.97% with a reinvestment rate of 4.44%. And for fiscal year 24-25, the weighted average earnings is projected at 3.84% with a reinvestment rate of 3.76%. We also have grants and reimbursements. They include executed grants, awarded grants, grants due under the SRF program, and the Prop 1 IRWIM Round 2 grant. Although the timing of when we receive grant reimbursement varies, we have made our best estimate for fiscal year 23-24, and that we project that we'll receive $11.6 million in reimbursements and $10.1 million in fiscal year 24-25. In fiscal year 23-24, reimbursements of about $3.8 million are expected from DWR for the PFAS treatment facilities, recycled water in the Sand Canyon sewer relocation, Also part of that 11.6 million is 6.4 million from the State Water Resources Control Board, from the Lark Ranch Pipeline and PFAS treatment facilities, and 1.3 million from the Bureau of Reclamation for PFAS treatment facilities, Rosedale Phase 2 wells, and the AMI project. This category also includes reimbursements from the Whitaker Settlement Agreement for perchlorate O&M and CIP at about $4.2 million in fiscal year 23-24 and about $3 million in fiscal year 24-25. Not included in this budget is a potential for another $15.9 million of grants where we have submitted an application or an application is in progress but not yet awarded. Those projects include funds for PFAS treatment facilities, equipping Saugus wells 3 and 4, conservation program funding, and the GSA monitoring wells. Next slide. So also on page 197 is a summary expense budget. Go back one. Maybe the next. There should be a proposed budget expense. There, right there. This is the summary expense budget. There is an overall increase in expenses in fiscal year 23-24 of 4.7% from the adopted budget of fiscal year 22-23 and 2.3% from the proposed fiscal year 24-25 budget from the fiscal year 23-24 proposed budget. There are separate pages for each department in your packet. Any expenses from the prior year that have a change of more than 10% and $20,000 are footnoted in that department to explain that change. At a high level, in the management category, there actually wasn't an increase, but there was a decrease. And that's primarily because there's an election expense that happens every other year. So it is not projected in fiscal year 23-24, but it is in 24-25. And also there is a reduction of just general legal expense as well as perchlorate litigation expense. In the finance administration and IT department, in fiscal year 23-24, this budget is projected at $23.9 million, which is an increase of 15%, which equates to $3.2 million over the fiscal year 22-23 adopted budget. There are several explanations for the increase in this department, but most relevant are the increases to technology services of 28% due to additional applications for customer care and finance, as well as maintenance to the agency's wide camera system. Also for additional staffing, which includes salary and benefits and COLA, and projected increases to liability insurance. And that liability insurance is general liability, property liability, cyber liability, earthquake, flood, pretty much all of our insurance with the exception of workers' compensation. In fiscal year 24-25, there's an increase of 7.8% from fiscal year 23-24. The most significant change is COLA salary and benefits for additional staffing, expenses for the WIFIA application, and ratepayer advocate services and liability insurance. Under pumping wells and storage, this department is projected to increase by 17%, which equates to $2.6 million over fiscal year 22-23. The most significant change is in power costs. Increased purchase power costs, as well as including a contingency to cover solar panel offsets, just in case the solar fields are not producing at capacity. And in fiscal year 24-25, this department is projecting a 7% increase over the prior year, fiscal year 23-24, for COLA, additional expenses for the PFAS treatment facilities, and purchase power costs. In the water quality treatment and maintenance department, in fiscal year 23-24, this department increased by 20%, which is about $1.8 million, over fiscal year 22-23 adopted budget. The primary increase is due to the higher chemical costs needed to treat and disinfect drinking water, regulatory fees, and employee-related expenses, salary, and benefits. In water resources, in fiscal year 22-23, this department is projected to be about 19% higher than about $2.3 million than the prior year, fiscal year 22-23, primarily due to salary and benefits for additional staffing, COLA, outside services to maintain the solar fields, additions to professional services for the conservation long-term framework, and sustainability initiatives and an increase to the GSA budget. For debt service, beginning in fiscal year 23-24, the estimated annual debt service payments for the 2023A bond issue have been included. On the capital PAYGO, this amount is the amount of funds available from PAYGO that is funded by rates and other revenue sources. Next slide. This is just a graphic of our expenses, just showing up the largest portion of where our operating expenses are, 64% in the first year, 66% in the second year. The pie chart is pretty close. It's only 2.3% in between each. Next slide. So on our reserves, our proposed budget for fiscal year 23-24 is $121 million, and that's fully funded. In fiscal year 24-25, the beginning of the year, we're projecting at about $127 million, but when we go through the capital projects, we'll see that we need to utilize some of those capital reserve funds, which brings our reserves down to 96%, which is about 76% funded. Next slide. This is just a snip of our state water contract budget. It's not necessarily part of the operating and capital budget. We'll be bringing this item in July to the board just to review the agency set property tax rate. But this does show what our beginning balance is at the end of this year to roll into next year. We can just start seeing a trend that our property tax that we'll be receiving is starting to trend a little bit lower than our expenses, assuming expenses are projecting at the rate that we've been told. Next slide. Okay, so I am going to, we're going to go to Courtney's presentation, and he's going to go over the capital program in detail, and then we will come back to this presentation.
All right, thank you very much. This is a big overview of a very large capital improvement program. A lot of our program and a lot of the specialized slides are related to engineering and operations because that's where our focus is, but we do have the slides for a comprehensive look at administration and water resources, and all staff are available here today to answer those questions if you have specific project questions on any of those other areas. Next slide, please. This should look familiar. It was the same slide that Rochelle had up at the end of her presentation, the fiscal year 24 PAYGO budget. The bottom shows the proposed $76 million total budget, as well as the proposed funding. The funding is $18 million from reserves or from revenues anticipated this year, $49.7 million from carryover of unspent funds from last year, and then $8.5 million from connection fees to offset expansion projects in the SCV Water District area. So next slide, please. This is for fiscal year 25 PAYGO budget. You can see the budget is for $55.7 million, $15.7 million from revenue, $8.9 from carryover unspent funds. And this is where Rochelle talked about the potential for the $30.9 million in reserves. We will obviously be looking at this closely and trying to eliminate the need to use reserves. If we are able to transfer some of this using WIFIA financing, we will do so. And then there's always the potential that we will not be able to complete all the projects due to unforeseen circumstances, like let's say it rains for 2 months and we can't do the construction projects that we expected. Those things will impact whether or not we can complete all those projects. Next slide, please. So I wanted to focus on the projects that are greater than $1 million in our CIP. This is a large budget, be difficult for us to complete all the projects. However, several of the projects have already been designed and they're ready to move to construction. On this slide here, you can see the C next to ones that we anticipate in construction this next fiscal year, which is almost all of them. That's why the numbers tend to be a little higher as well. Construction costs are higher than if you were just doing design. So you're going to see a lot of the projects moving forward. It is obvious that material shortages and regulations can impact our project schedules, but we do need to make sure we get these projects approved and get started in order to reach their completion. And we will be doing our best to move these forward through to completion. Next slide, please. This is the remainder of that list with a total project for CIP, engineering CIP of $39 million for fiscal year 23-24 and $21.9 million for 24-25. Now we're going to go into some project specifics. Next slide, please. Saugus 3 and 4, I included a picture of the actual well drilling. They are currently doing zone testing. There we go. Thank you. This project is approved and in construction. The new wells are designed to replace other wells that were impacted by PFAS, and a portion of this project will be reimbursed through settlement agreement. Each well that is constructed is estimated to produce about 2,000 gallons per minute, or about 3,250 acre feet per year. Perchlorate, yeah. Thank you. Sorry. Can't even read my own paper. We're off on our slides here. Can we go back to the... We're on the wrong presentation, I think. There we go. Next one. Next slide, please. Okay. Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant underground storage tank replacement. The project is currently being advertised for construction. We're expecting bid opening April 26th. We'll plan on going to the June E&O and hopefully shortly after to the full board and then award for construction, assuming we obtain approval. Next slide, please. We went one too many. Can we go back? Oh, no, there we go. Sorry. Yeah, next slide. All right, I can barely see that with my glasses on. I should take them off, but then I can't read. We are using this existing development. Where are we at now? Okay, I may have to skip that. So we're doing the groundwater treatment projects. We have... several projects in the works. We have, you can see on the bottom, the Santa Clara Hanby wells and the various other wells, well 201, 205, Saugus 1 and 2, the T, U, and S wells, all at various stages of construction. This is probably the single largest item collectively in our CIP, and we're looking to recover up to 17,000 acre feet of water through this treatment, managing this treatment. Next slide, please. Dean zone improvements. We are utilizing the proposed development to correct deficiencies identified in the 2013 master plan. The developer is required to pay their fair share of all of their development facilities. That means all portions are required for the development. And the agency has proposed design expansion to include the existing system deficiencies. You can see there the benefits of participation are the developer contributed land, developer conducted environmental review, and you also gain some economies of scale, and it will address the deficiencies in our system for this Dean zone. That project is also currently in finished with design and is beginning construction, so we are anticipating the completion of that project by sometime end of 2024, mid to end of 2024. Next slide, please. So as you remember from Oh, interesting. This is an older slide. If you remember from last year, the engineering and operations PAYGO budget was combined. We ended up putting all of the pipeline projects, working with operations. We take a lot more of that into engineering to do the pipeline design. Some of the numbers here are a little individual for each individual project, but in summary, for 23-24, there's about $14 million in replacement pipelines. And for 24-25, there's about $14.2 million. About $2 million of that each year is operations doing the work, and about $12 million each year is engineering contracting out the pipeline replacement and adding that in. Some of the pipelines that you will see, next slide, please. Some of the pipelines you'll see, such as the Dickinson pipeline replacement, the construction contract was awarded at the March 21st board meeting. The notice to proceed is anticipated to be released this year or this April. Smythe pipeline replacement design is being finalized, and DDW waivers are prepared, and construction should occur this fiscal year. We're also doing the Abdale, Maple Bay Court, Beech Grove Court pipeline replacement. We're doing the finalization of design and DDW waivers for that project as well. Next slide, please. We also have several operations-led pipeline projects that you see here. We have the design previously done by an engineer that the agency has worked with for a number of years. Unfortunately, he passed away recently, and Andel passed away. We are looking to work with his CAD drafter and to finalize some of this work. And so we're in talks with him right now, hopefully to finalize some of that design. And then we may take some more of this design through our consultants, and then consider other options on how to do the in-house design for operations work. Next slide, please. Other operations overview, you know, the operations CIP is typically the ones that require limited engineering support. They consist of several general categories, and so a lot of these slides we have here are showing those general categories with the budgets and the type of work that they would be doing on there under those projects. Next slide, please. The operations budget that you see is $16.7 million for fiscal year 23-24. And $14.5 million for 24-25. You can see that they have the pipeline and pipeline improvements projects, about $2.1 and $2.2 million that we discussed in prior slides, and then a variety of other projects. Next slide, please. So grouping them into categories, looking at storage tank and tank improvement replacements, total storage tanks, we have 102 tanks. That includes our recycled water and concrete reservoir and plant water tanks. We normally want to dive those every 3 to 5 years for inspection. And then we have some key projects coming up in this next fiscal year of Copper Hill 1, North Oaks 1, and North Oaks 4 for recoding. Next slide, please. Been talking about a lot about our AMI and getting some of the grant proposal, looking at meter replacement due to age, volume or read style, making sure that we're more consistent across the whole valley. The grant proposed area is 7,500 meters replaced, and general replacements targeting about 3,700. Next slide, please. We have a total of 55 wells, so those also have to be maintained and reviewed, making sure you're maintaining your specific capacity, production, the age. Obviously, with treatment, there's some other considerations. Some of our key projects here are Saugus 1 and 2 and Gita project. Next slide, please. We included the equipment replacements, although that's technically not in our budget anymore. But when you're looking at CIP and looking at the engineering and operations, a lot of this higher dollar equipment is for us and the vehicles. So we do have many of them that are greater than 100,000 miles, greater than 10 years old, on older backhoe and heavy equipment as well. So this budget actually shows up in administration's budget line item. Next slide, please. You can see the administration, technology, and fleet PAYGO budget. Ultimately, for fiscal year 23-24 is $7.1 million, and for 24-25 is $5.2 million. And of that, the vehicles are about $1.9 and $1.8, respectively. And then they will go into some of the other projects later on today in the committee meeting to talk about the compressor, the air compressor, or the HVAC system replacement here for the administration building. Next slide, please. The water resources PAYGO budget. I think we didn't include the fiscal 24-25. We have the fiscal year 23-24 is $13.4 million and 24-25 is $13.9. Largest expenditures for these are the Buena Vista Rosedale Rio Bravo program and the Resiliency Master Plan, which we typically refer to as a resiliency initiative. So any questions on the water resources, we can forward over to Steve Cole. I believe he's online. Next slide, please. And these are more slides from a duplicate of what Rochelle has already showed. So I'll pass back to her.
Bringing up the presentation. So we'll go next slide. back one. There we go. So here's the capital plan and how it's calculated. This is very summarized form, but is also included in the pro forma and the financial summary of your packet. So if we look at that middle column for fiscal year 23-24, we have our revenues of $155 million, which we've already talked about. We have our general departmental expense of $99 million. We have our debt service of $37.5 million. The transfer of other funds in cash. So as Courtney had mentioned, we have about $48 million of carryover funds from the prior couple of years. And then we also have about $8.5 million of capacity fee funds in the San Lucretia Water Division that will also be utilized to complete some of the projects in the Santa Clarita area. Our total CIP for the year is for PAYGO is $76 million, minus that $58 million from the transfer of other funds. Which leaves that $18 million that we had seen. That's the amount of money that that comes from rates and other revenue sources to fund our PAYGO on an annual basis. That same calculation for fiscal year 24-25 and going through the revenues and expenses, the amount funded from rates and other revenues is $15.7 million. Next slide. This is just shows the debt funded projects. We look at the first green column, the adopted budget for fiscal year 22-23. We can see that we had planned the year to start with about $18 million, add $75 million of bond proceeds, have some interest earnings and some capital project expenditures. That didn't quite happen in this fiscal year. So the projected fiscal year is starting with that same $18 million. We having some interest earnings, about $19 million in capital projects. And then in fiscal year 23-24, we're expecting that $75 million bond issue in July. So that hits this next fiscal year. Some larger interest earnings are capital projects that Court just went over for debt funded projects of $46.7 million. Which has a balance of $29.2 million. We roll that into the next fiscal year for fiscal year 24-25. And it looks like based on our schedule that the first part of our WIFI loan, we could potentially be receiving $63 million. We still have some interest earnings and we have about $92.7.8 million of debt funded projects. which leaves the balance in that year about $75 million. And with the WIFIA loan, once we get approved, I think our first loan tranche is about $190 million. We draw on that when we need it. Next slide. So in summary, we show that we have a balanced budget. Our utilization of our approved rate study, which includes that 6.5% of our revenue adjustment as approved in the rate study for fiscal year 24 and fiscal year 25. Utilization of carryover funds to complete the two-year capital PAYGO plan. We have included the 7 new positions that the board approved at the last board meeting. And we have included funding for the strategic initiatives, which include the Groundwater Management Act, Water Resilience Initiative, technology improvements, the EV vehicles and equipment improvements, and PFAS treatment. Next slide. So the recommendation is that the Finance Administration Committee recommends the Board of Directors approve a resolution adopting the fiscal year 23-24 and fiscal year 24-25 biennial budget. And that concludes our report.
Thank you, Rochelle. Courtney, do we have any questions from the public?
We do have public comment. Cam Noltmeyer, you may approach the podium. Yes, this is the budget item.
I did have some questions. I still have a lot of questions, and I'm getting more questions by just listening to you. But I will save them for another time because I see you keep going in one direction, and it doesn't seem to be for the benefit of the ratepayers in any direction at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our public comment.
All right. I open it up for discussion. I would just start out by saying that at the engineering E&O committee meeting at the beginning of the month, we saw the capital program that Courtney just went through with us. And one of the biggest comments of his comment mine too is that it's quite ambitious, and especially since we're not spending that much money right now very easily. So we but to have these projects approved and ready to go is important for keeping, you might say, the pedal to the metal to keep these projects happening. So with that, I open up to the other board members. Any comments? Vice President Gusak.
Okay. Hopefully quick questions. You gave a 2-year look ahead on capital improvement. How far out do we plan in general? Just ballpark? I mean,
we have a 10-year plan for our all of our projects, and actually the master plan does a 20-year horizon.
So okay,
we advance that and roll it along.
Okay. And then I don't know enough about the Water Resiliency Initiative, but is that, I'm just questioning why it's in capital. Isn't it largely modeling, or am I mistaken on what it is?
And in capital, I don't know.
Is that for Steve that's in the Water Resources Group?
Yeah.
You want me to jump in, Rochelle?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sure. I Director Goodside, I think it's a good question. I think this year we really tried to move all the planning things over into just the general planning budget. The resilience initiative we decided to leave in the capital, I think mainly because it is to serve to make some of the generational investment decisions. At least that's how we walk through it. So whether you're investing in sites or groundwater banking or those types of really large investments, it was, you know, a large part of that is the planning effort leading up to those. So that's why we left it in there. Is that the right place for it or not? I'm still probably quite not sure.
Okay. No, that explains it. It's essentially planning that will inform potential capital investments down the road. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was just not sure if I was misremembering what it was either. So thank you. That was all.
Director
Almatrage. Actually, I don't have a question. I just have a quick comment. I just want to say thank you to Ms. Patterson and Mr. Mail for the presentations. And just say that I'm keeping my fingers and my toes and my arms and my legs crossed for that $15.9 million funding, grant funding that could potentially come our way, because that would be a nice chunk of help. And thank you to Ms. Fowler for always doing great work and finding grant funding for us. So that's it. Thanks.
Director Colley.
Yeah, I'm happy to see us moving more into PAYGO. So certainly I like the trend. Want to see more of that. So that been agitating for that for a couple of days now.
Vice President Gusite.
I just wanted to say I really liked the budget overview presentation. I felt that it was, you know, a good summary, good level of detail. So it was nice to see, easy to read slides, easy to understand. I liked it.
With that, we move on to the next item. Do we need to have any action of the committee?
Just if you want to move it to the board.
Yes.
We are in it was originally planned to go to the May 2nd meeting, but we're asking that we push it to the May 16th meeting just to give us some more time to polish the narratives, so you when you see the document, it's the full document with all the components.
Oh, that's right. Okay. All right, so we move on to item number 5. Recommend approval of a construction contract with EMCOR Services, Mesa Energy, for replacement of the HVAC chiller at Rio Vista. Ms. Patterson?
Yes, so I'm going to start the presentation, and if there are any like detail questions on the chiller, we have Roland Valiente. He's our facility supervisor, and he can answer those specific questions. But I will go at a high level of the RFP process and the selection of the vendor. So next slide. Over the years, the current chiller provided the necessary temperature control, which is very cool in here tonight. So it's working very well. As Matt went to get his jacket.
We've made changes, you know, this past, you know, week.
And supported the expansion of the Rio Vista's main administration building. But for the past 5 years, the current chiller has become inefficient and does malfunction quite often. We have tried to limp the existing system along, but knew it was time to look to replace the unit. In the picture right above, that is our existing chiller. It's a York chiller that was installed back in the late 90s. Next slide. A couple more pictures of the chiller. So the existing chiller is has a higher power consumption, it has loud operation, erratic cooling conditions, and high maintenance costs. Parts for the existing chiller are becoming discontinued. For example, the current use of refrigerant R22 has been phased out. Next slide. We did go through an RFP process. So the RFP was advertised, providing details of the project and scope of work. We used Planet Bids was utilized for this process. Contractors were required a site visit to assess the project as per the scope of work. There were questions and answers, and separate discussions were held to identify any other needs or questions that the proposers had. The RFPs were reviewed, and the RFPs were scored based on RFP criteria and minimum qualifications, which was laid out in the scope of work in the RFP. The contract award is based on the most qualified contractor. Doesn't necessarily have to be the lowest cost, but the qualified contractor based on our scoring criteria, the detail and understanding of the scope of work, timeliness, workmanship, and experience. Next slide. So as previously shown in February of 23, the agency issued the request for proposal for replacement of the HVAC system, the chiller at Rio Vista. The scope of work requested bids to replace the existing chiller with a high energy efficient and oil-free unit, look for units with redundancy and a high ERR rating, potential of expandability, quiet operation, compatible with the agency's current building automation system, and using a refrigerant that is compliant. There were four responses to the RFP, and based on the results of the scoring matrix, MCOR Services was selected as the firm that best meets the agency's needs. The chiller replacement project, which includes purchasing a modern chiller along with installation services and the installation of a leak detection system. Next slide. When it comes to refrigerants, this is a quick review on the different types of refrigerants that are used in commercial chillers. Our existing chiller uses R22 refrigerant, which has been banned in all new equipment. It is still available for and at a higher cost while supplies last for units made prior to 2010. The R410A refrigerant is also being phased out and no longer available for units manufactured in 2023 and after. Although the R513A, which is also labeled as XP10, is not a new refrigerant to the market, it is a non-depleting ozone refrigerant and is recommended for new or replacement HVAC units, according to the EPA. Next slide. These are some specifications for the different types of chillers that three of the bidders had proposed. So staff expects that the agency can improve the cooling capacity for the building and can implement safety into the daily operations of the staff by installing a refrigerant leak detection system. Most importantly, staff expects to recognize a 15% reduction in the cost of maintenance by installing a modern oil-free chiller that provides the highest level of reliability and will perform at 25% more efficiency and deliver a low noise operation. The ERR or EER is the energy efficiency ratio of an HVAC cooling device and is the ratio of output cooling energy to the input electrical energy at a given operating point. The higher EER rating equates to a more efficient unit. And in the table above, we can see that the MCOR TurboCore chiller that they had proposed has the highest EER rating. The integrated part load valve, which is the IPLV, is a performance characteristic developed by the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. It is most commonly used to describe the performance of a chiller capable of capacity modulation, unlike an EER, which describes the efficiency at full load conditions. The IPLV is derived from the equipment efficiency while operating at various capacities. Since a chiller does not always run at 100% capacity, the IPLV is also used and considered to determine energy usage and operating costs throughout the lifetime of the equipment. The next line is the decibel level, and that is a unit measure. It measures the intensity of sound. The scale is a logarithmic one, meaning that at 10 decibel increase in sound level corresponds to a tenfold increase in sound intensity. Bless you. So as an example, a decibel measurement of common sounds are, so zero is near total silence. 15 is a whisper. 60 decibels is normal conversation. 70 decibels is equivalent to a vacuum cleaner or a hairdryer. 90 decibels is equivalent to a lawnmower or a motorcycle. At 120 decibels, a rock concert or jet engine. And at 140 decibels, like a firecracker or firework. So when an HVAC system makes too much noise, not only is it being disruptive and a safety hazard, but it is also a sign that energy is being wasted and not used efficiently. And we can see that the M-Core TurboCore chiller has the best of these three, including the fourth one, which is the refrigerant type, which is the ozone-friendly refrigerant. Next slide. So although M-Core was the highest qualified proposal, they scored the highest based on the scoring criteria included in the RFP. So M-Core's proposed approach included to minimize the chiller downtime and to replace the chiller unit in 6 days. M-Core has proposed a chiller unit that has eco-friendly refrigerant, that has no refrigerant phase-out timeframe and is energy efficient. And the M-Core has included in their price the exhaust and leak detection system, personnel overtime to complete the project faster, and has done research to ensure the agency receives the best chiller, high-end energy efficiency, no refrigerant phase-out, low noise operation, and redundancy. Although the second ranked bidder was $40,000 under the M-Core proposal, the Allison proposal estimated keeping the chiller down for a minimum of 3 weeks. This is a concern that will force the agency to add the cost of renting a portable HVAC system, which is estimated to increase the project cost by approximately $40,000 or more for setup and rental of a portable chiller. Allison included in their price the exhaust and leak detection system, which was a requirement of the RFP, but has a longer time frame to finish. And also the chiller that they propose has the other refrigerant, the 410AR. Next slide. I have to go back. Our other considerations, we added contingencies to the proposed cost of the project. We're considering adjusting staff schedules for that 1 week to minimize cooling discomfort of the building and hopefully not on a board meeting week. Add cost of the SCB buildings and grounds support overtime. The goal is to have the work done during normal operation and off hours, including a weekend and a dark Friday. And the project will have a quick turnaround. Next slide. These are just the pictures of the other two units that were proposed, the Allison, the multi-stack modular chiller, just how it looks, and the diversified thermal services, which is the newer York chiller. Next slide. So the recommendation is that the Finance Administration Committee recommend to the Board of Directors to authorize the General Manager to enter into a construction contract with M-Core for a not-to-exceed amount of $541,100 for the chiller replacement at Rio Vista Main Administration Building, but for a total project cost of $600,000, which will include any staff time. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. You did a fine job there explaining all those terms. Do we have any questions from the public or comments?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
With that, I open up the discussion to the board members. Any questions? Director Armitage.
Thank you for that presentation. I felt that was very thorough, and I feel very solid in the decision I think this group will make. And just wanted to say thank you also to Mr. Valiente for being online and available. I don't have any questions for him, but just thank you also for the pictures in the presentation for us visual learners. I think it's always nice to have the pictures to see what the equipment looks like. But yeah, I mean, I know it seems we're spending a little extra, or we're picking the one that's a higher cost, but it seems to make sense based on what you presented to us. I mean, the option we're choosing doesn't have a phase out refrigerant. It's environmentally friendly, and it sounds like because it's more efficient, we may save costs going forward. So this makes sense to me. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, okay.
Two questions, probably for Mr. Villande. Did I pronounce that right? So first on phase out, what does that mean? Does the phase out mean that you can buy a different refrigerant and maybe some conversion equipment, like different kind of seals or something? Would the equipment still be usable, or would the equipment have to be essentially scrapped when phased out? And what is the phase out timeline? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. The phase out means basically the manufacturers, refrigerant manufacturers, will stop producing the type of refrigerant. 410A is one of those. R22 is in that, already in that process. You know, right now they're depleting any leftovers of R22. But phase out means, you know, basically stopping that production, and at some point, you know, and even starting this year, 2023, any manufacturers of HVAC equipment, they will no longer be able to manufacture equipment using R22 410A, basically.
Oh, okay.
And the equipment, as it is right now, our current chiller as R22, which completely has been phased out. And right now, you know, I mean, we're able to get refrigerant, but at a very, very higher cost, basically about, you know, $150 to $200 per pound.
Okay, and do you have any idea? The 410A is obviously behind that on phase out. When's the 410A going away? I mean, would this last for 30 years, or is it a near-term phase out on the 410A?
410A is 2023, is already in the phase out, mode, basically. It might last, you know, like, for a better word, you know, the storage, you know, companies using 410A, you know, may last for the next year, 2 years, 5 years, depending on the usage. So there is no really, you know, time frame. You know,
okay, so.
But moving forward, you know, I mean, the idea in the industry is that nobody will be able to really sell, you know, pretty much, you know, equipment with 410A. And if we are lucky to get, you know, 410A, then, you know, we'll be paying, you know, a higher price on per pound, basically.
Okay, so even though they can sell you a new unit today, we won't be able to use it for all that much longer.
Correct.
Okay, and then correct. Related question on the R513A. You know, I know a lot of times new equipment might not have the ability to have a long track record. What do we know about this type of equipment? Has chillers with this material been proven in the field? Is it guaranteed, and is it available?
Yes, to all of the above. 513A has been in the industry for a while, and is one of the most recent, kind of like the past 10 years, eco-friendly type of, you know, refrigerants. This is being used currently in many different chillers. Especially, you know, with the turbo cores, the multi-stacks, it really, you know, the price on the equipment that uses this type of refrigerant is of a higher value dollar, because, you know, it's a non-depleting ozone, you know, type of refrigerant. And I think, you know, the industry, what the industry is doing, and I use the industry, you know, as the standard, is they're trying to push out, you know, all these equipment with 410A, basically. 410A is the king right now. And they're trying to, you know, pretty much, you know, deplete all this equipment that is out there, and then really, you know, move into the 13.8, you know, moving forward. I think, you know, MCOR has done a great job of really looking for the chiller unit that will give us, you know, the best value that will put us in that category of Title 24 compliance. And they really listened to us, you know, when we were looking, we're doing the job walks, basically saying, hey, we're looking for an equipment that will put us in that compliance mode moving forward for the next 10, 15, 20 years, and that will be energy efficient and eco-friendly, basically.
Okay, well, just to clarify, if it doesn't work, we have some kind of guarantee. If it's 115 degrees outside and it's 95 in here, they have to help us fix it for this price, right? Is that a correct statement?
That is a correct statement. There is a warranty and everything that they have provided. And it is a proven technology. The University of British Columbia and other, the hotel industry, they're using these products basically. And they're using these products in very tropical weathers. And they're proven. They're proven basically 100 and plus degrees in tropical weather, humidity. We don't see the humidity like in the tropical weather, you know. But, you know, they're proven, and MCOR, you know, is really, you know, behind that and will support us and will provide the technical services. And they have the expertise to really, you know, troubleshoot anything with this type of chiller. But I'm very confident that, you know, what we're getting and what MCOR is, you know, really, you know, presenting to us, you know, we'll go a long way, you know, with our the agency vision, which is, you know, to be energy efficient, friendly, and really provide the best comforts, you know, for everybody in the building.
Okay, and it is near term available, since it's going to go in next year's budget. It's not a long lead time.
It could be up to 30 weeks, but it would put us in the middle of next year's budget. We were hoping for maybe a January or February retrofit, so it wasn't extremely hot. Mm-hmm. So open the windows and still be comfortable, but that's what we're aiming for.
Okay. I'll just close with, I hate being hot. So I hope it works.
We'll make comment, sure it's not on a board.
No, not about the changeover, just long-term. I heard you say 105, and I know it's been hotter than 105 here. And I also know some countries that are hot and tropical, like they like it like that. And we're a little spoiled here. I think probably 75 would be good if we, you know, hopefully it attains that when it's running. That's my closing comment.
Director Colley.
So Roland, your efficiency ratios there are pretty impressive. Glad to see that. I actually would have liked to see if you'd done any analysis on the payback compared to our current system. I would not be surprised if the system, if you compare it to today's system, would pay for itself in pretty short order. But nonetheless, I'm supportive. The only comment I've got in addition is that I think before you were even hired, I probably made a comment at some board meeting suggesting that we look under the SGIP program at ice storage systems. There's a system called, I believe, Ice Bear that does ice storage basically off peak, and then, of course, uses that cold ice to chill during hot days. I'd appreciate it if at some point you just did at least a little bit of a look and see if that sort of a system would make sense. And maybe just educate yourself enough to, you know, next time we need something like this, that at least gets looked at. Generally, the systems last time I looked were incredibly expensive and probably very difficult to get to pencil out. And it wouldn't be a surprise to me if it would not pencil today. But it is something I'd like to have you aware of and consider, if you will. if not in this system, but perhaps in the future, because this isn't the only building we've got. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
At the pleasure of the committee, would we put this on the consent calendar? Yes. Yes. Go ahead and do that. All right. Moving on to item number 6. Recommend receiving filing of the February 2023 financial report. Rochelle.
Okay. So for February, our operating revenues were over budget by $237,000. Our operating expenses were under budget by about $2.4 million. Our net operating revenues were $2.6 million. Non-operating revenues were under budget by $2.7 million, and that's primarily due to the lower than expected receipts of facility capacity fees. Our PAYGO was under budget by about $4.3 million. That all led to an increase of net position of about $1.2 million. And looking at the year to date through February, we are under budget in our operating revenues of about $8.8 million, but we're also under budget in expenses of about $8.4 million. So our net operating of about $320,000 after non-operating and debt service were included. We have an increase of net position of about $37 million when we look at year-to-date, and that's primarily sitting in that PAYGO category, which is allowing us to carry over a lot of those funds for the next capital year. And that is all that I had on the finance section, unless there's anything else in the packet. We did include this month, the Chandler Asset Management Investment Statement. It's quite lengthy. I think it's about 100 pages or so. But just to, you know, I know there's been some, talk of all the, banking failures, and we thought it would be good to show where all of our investments are. So if you want to take a look through all of that. And so we will probably present that quarterly just to have it in the packet. So you have it for additional information. That's really the only changes in the packet this month.
Are there any public comment on this item?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Board of Directors? Director Armitage?
To piggyback on the last statement you just made, I just want to thank you for the flow of information that you've been giving us to the committee in terms of the safety of the investments, given the banking world volatility in the recent past. So just want to say thank you for that. I really appreciate the proactiveness of that. And then I just have one quick question. And so on the statement of revenue and expenses, it shows a 93% under budget for recycled water, which prompted a question in my mind is this is more of an operations question. What happens to our recycled water that gets produced by the Valencia treatment plant that doesn't get used?
It's a good question. I think it goes into the river.
The river. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But
right. And the recycled water is for outdoor use. And because of February being as wet as it was, there wasn't a lot of demand.
Yeah, I saw your note there. Thank you. But I'm like, well, what happens to it? So, all right. Thanks.
Yeah, they don't really have a lot of seasonal storage. That's something that, probably in the top 10 of woulda, shoulda, couldas in this valley, somebody should have put in seasonal recycled water storage. But everywhere else where it's widely used, there's some element of seasonal storage in the equation that really makes it work better.
Any other comments or questions? With that, we move on to item 7, committee planning calendar.
So next month could be a big one. The smaller items are approving the appropriations for the remainder of this fiscal year and then next year. but also recommending approval of the preliminary official statement. That's for the 2023 bond issue. And then we'll have a couple presentations from one from the technology group, and then another one from Fleet and More Housing update. And then we'll have our third quarter quarterly report.
Okay. Any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Any questions? Moving on. Item 7 is a request for future agenda items. None. We move on to the last item, your general report.
Just a couple things. We have our interim audit begins May 1st. It feels like we just finished it and it's back. We are also in the midst of our WIFIA application. We're currently going through each project to determine eligibility. There are some projects that we are currently working on that are not eligible because according to WIFIA, you have to meet the requirements, which means they have to be bid and contracted using Davis-Bacon, American Iron and Steel, has to follow the BABA Act. And they have certain procurement requirements. And if they've already been contracted and they've already been bid, those items have not been included in those contracts. Majority of those are expected to be funded and constructed with a 2023 bond issue. So we're okay with that. But we are going through each project to determine which projects are eligible and which are ineligible based on our 10-year capital program that we had had supplied when we went through our scenarios. We also will be, our customer care department will have a booth at the COC's Farmers Market and Newhall Farmers Market. And then as part of that outreach of just being in the community, we will also communicate the LEWAP program for the low-income water assistance program, especially in the Newhall Farmers Market area, just in case, some of the people in that community haven't seen that messaging. And that's all I had in my general report.
Thank you. Any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Any questions from the board members? Director Armitage.
In terms of the WIFIA loan selection process, I feel like our capital improvement project list is rather lengthy that I can't imagine that we'd have a hard time finding enough of our projects that we could apply for, right? I mean, there's no concern for that.
No, we wanted to include all of our projects, PAYGO, all of our debt funded projects that we had previously identified as what being funded maybe by bond proceeds or some other types of funding. But not all projects are eligible. WIFIA is the Water Innovation Financing Act, and part of it is construction. Some of our items may be on, technology services. We have a $3 million budget. Not all of that may be supported by WIFIA. So some of it we'll have to pull out and say technology services PAYGO, technology services WIFIA. So like probably our security camera work that we're going to go out and contract to have our security cameras done, those can probably be eligible for WIFIA, but maybe not our individual like computers and those types of things. So that's what we're going through. Once we get kind of our project list, we'll meet with the EPA prior to our application, and they'll help us go through that list to try to identify project costs. We also can go back to some of those projects that we've already incurred costs on, but we haven't contracted yet, and we can go back and get prior costs. So we're trying to look at everything we can to take advantage of the WIFIA financing, but knowing that some of our projects will not be eligible.
Yeah. Okay. And then last finishing comment, super excited about the farmers market booth. And I may have missed it. Did you say it was going to be a one-time thing, or is it kind of like a little bit of an ongoing?
I think they were going to do it a couple times. Okay. That the LEWAP program ends in August. So they wanted to make sure they got out there and at least had some type of communication at the Newhall Farmers Market. So it's part of the communications group and customer care group, them partnering and trying to just use it as just an outreach platform, but also identifying that one program at the same time.
I think that's wonderful. Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, I can adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.